This episode of Between the Rows was brought to you in part by Bayer. Bayer continues to make significant investments into the development of new breeding technologies and state-of-the-art cropping solutions to ensure the profitability and sustainability of your farm. This season, grow with confidence. Grow with Bayer. Welcome to Between the Rows, where you get to hear the stories behind the stories in Canada's leading farm papers. Today, we hear from David Laub of the University of Manitoba about his research and keynote address to the Canadian Soil Health Summit.
We had been trying to assess the amount of soil loss and the economic value of that loss.
Alan Dawson of the Manitoba Cooperator wonders if farmers and railways are in a new era of grain transportation.
I think the grain industry as a whole is hoping that we've put some of those terrible times in the past things will be better in the future.
And the Western producer's Darce McMillan brings us a look at the markets.
2013, the final tally on canola was more than 25% larger than it was in August. And in 2015, the final number was a whopping 38% larger than in August.
All on Between the Rows with this week's host, Gord Gilmore.
Hello, and welcome to Between the Rows. I'm your host this week, Gord Gilmore. Glacier Farm Media editorial director Laura Rance recently attended a national summit on Canadian soil health in Guelph. One of the keynote speakers was David Laub, a soil scientist with the University of Manitoba. He's been studying how much soil erosion costs Canadian farmers in lost productivity. Laura spoke to him after his presentation about his findings.
In looking at soil degradation and the cost of it, I focused in on soil erosion, which is largely, it's believed to be the largest component of the soil degradation. And we had been trying to assess the amount of soil loss that's occurred in different parts of the country and the associated crop loss that's incurred because of that and the economic value of that loss associated with the market values over time.
So you didn't look at the indirect effects of this?
No, we looked specifically at crop production loss. We didn't look at the inefficiencies associated with higher input use, like pesticides and fertilizer, which commonly occurs in highly degraded landscapes. And we didn't look at any of the off-field effects, like sedimentation in ditches and navigable waterways or any ecological services associated with like algae blooms and eutrophication of surface waters.
But we know those costs are significant as well.
Yes, they are. They are often believed to be like the indirect costs associated with off-site impacts, like water quality, is often assumed to be about equal, if not larger, than the on-site effects. So those numbers are large, but they're very difficult to estimate.
So what are you finding?
It's rather startling. When we did our analysis looking at the cumulative soil loss and its impact on yield, accounting for changes in tillage systems, cropping changes that have occurred across the country, the actual loss in production and the associated loss in economic value was about $3.1 billion. Billion dollars. That's on an annual basis. So if you looked at what cumulatively would have occurred from the 1970s to now, you're probably looking at $40 to $60 billion lost in terms of economic potential for the ag industry.
But you also found that there's less soil at risk, per se.
That's true. Through conservation tillage, which is widely adopted, particularly in the prairies, there is a dramatic decrease in the amount of soil loss and the amount of land area, cropland area, across the country that's under moderate to severe loss. This has dramatically been reduced over the last 30 years. The problem is that last 10% of moderately to severely eroded land has high-value crops, and the value of those crops is increased. And so the economic impact on the industry is proportionally large because of those areas.
We're talking potatoes.
Potatoes, corn, soybeans are crops. They're not the only crops that are of concern, but those are certainly ones. There's a large acreage, expanding acreage, and high-value crops. And so that means that they have more and more of an economic impact. When you look at the whole production system.
We've essentially stemmed the decline, but we haven't restored the soil. Is that what you're finding?
Exactly. I think there was a perception that that if you went to no-till and you stopped the soil erosion, the soil would regenerate or restore itself. And that may be true. We have high organic matter inputs, but on those eroded areas, you have almost no potential to increase the organic matter. So those areas that most desperately need the restoration are unable to, unless you do something extraordinary.
Describe those areas to me. Would they be hilltops?
Yes, any hilltop. And you can see this across the country and hilltops all over the world. If you're driving around, you'll see eroded hilltops. So the light-colored hills and ridges like you see in the Prairie Pothole region of western Canada, they're very, very prevalent. You look on Google Earth, you can see it. Anywhere where you can see soil, you'll see the eroded hilltops. And so it's those areas. And that's about 15 to 30% of the landscape is that hilltop, which ends up being moderately to severely eroded because of historical tillage and current tillage. Fertilizer and better management of the crop in general can help mask some of that, but it won't necessarily eliminate that problem.
Why does this work matter?
Farmers have been able to deal with this. They have had increased yields at a farm scale, increased profits. They have been able to sustain their business, but they may not be at nearly their potential. And if farmers are dealing with lack of farm profit, there's a couple different ways they can deal with it. One is they can look for ways to increase production, and some of that may be consolidation of farms. So part of the response of farmers has been adopting technology, but some of it's actually changing the nature of farm production across regions of the country.
So what can farmers do about this?
They need to look at, stopping soil erosion. If they have soil erosion problems, they need to look at stopping it, reducing soil erosion. That would be the first thing. Then in terms of restoring it, you have to look at your management of crops. You need to look at opportunities to increase organic matter, particularly on those eroded hilltops. And one way is through crop production. And that could mean bringing in forages. And there's a lot of complexity with that. There's big decisions. If you're going to change your crop production system, that may not be amenable to most people. I know in Manitoba, there's farmers that actually put double the manure levels on their hilltops. They go in, they specifically double the rate of manure. They put double applications, or that may be the only place they apply manure. So farmers have been doing that. There's also farmers in many parts of Canada and in the United States where they actually collect soil at the bottom, topsoil that's accumulated at the bottom, and put it back on those hilltops and see an immediate restoration of yield. That's not common, but it is probably the most immediate and it's the most cost-effective way to do it. But it is a major technological shift that farmers would have to be willing to accept.
So essentially, we're still paying for this historical deficit, the historical erosion that has occurred in the past. We've stopped the decline of our soils to a large extent, but we're having to still compensate or find a way to restore the soils that have been damaged.
Correct. That's absolutely right. So the important thing for people to realize that conservation tillage and no-till or zero-till has maybe slowed, if not stopped, the problem from increasing, but the problem is still there. And it isn't overcome simply by changing tillage system. You have to look at organic matter inputs. It's to build up organic matter through changing cropping systems, it can be decades to increase the soil organic matter level 1%. And this is why it's so critical not to have the erosion, because erosion, you lose organic matter many times faster than you can possibly build it through cropping systems.
Thank you very much.
Thanks, Laura, for that report. You're listening to Between the Rows. I'm your host this week, Gord Gilmore. Later in the show, we'll be talking to the Western producers Darce McMillan about just how important the StatsCan grain numbers really are. Up first, however, is Alan Dawson of the Manitoba Cooperator. Alan, you had a story in the upcoming issue that posed the question, is it a new era for grain transportation? That's based on a new grain throughput record that was set in Western Canadian grain export terminals, Vancouver, Prince Rupert, and Thunder Bay, in the 2016-17 crop year that ended July 31st. So how much was moved and how significant is it?
Well, you know, I've been covering agriculture for a long time, since about 1980, and through much of my career, grain transportation has been a very contentious issue. An ongoing battle and a lot of problems. I mean, at times it seemed like grain transportation was a bit of a basket case. Now there has been, you know, improvements over the year. The system has been getting more efficient, and things have been improving. But then, you know, we saw things go off the rails, so to speak, in 2013-14 with that big backlog of grain.
So tell us a little bit about that. How critical was that that terrible situation in 13-14 in terms of driving this change that you've observed?
Well, you know, it got everybody's attention. It was a huge crop that year, a record 77 million metric ton crop, and then we had the worst winter in 100 years. It was bitterly cold for much of 2013-14, and the railways got behind in the grain shipping and had a hard time recovering. The railways, of course, blamed the big crop and the bad weather, but the Western Grain Elevators Association that represents the major grain companies contends that the railways just weren't, you know, fully prepared, and they argue, the Elevator Association argues, that that's partly because of the way the system is set up, that the railways have geographic monopolies and therefore don't have the same kind of market disciplines that would exist in a fully competitive rail market to, you know, invest in surge capacity to deal with problems that crop up like 2013-14. And, you know, there was a lot of spillover from that time. Not only did it get everybody's attention, including the governments, and I think that was a big one, because the government ordered the railways to move a certain amount of grain on a weekly basis or face fines. That led to the legislation, the Fair Rail for Farmers Act, and also the government initiated 1 year early a review of the Canadian Transportation Act, and that's led us to where we sort of are now with the Transportation Modernization Act, which is before Parliament, and grain shippers are hoping that that legislation will make the railways more accountable, perhaps subject to fines if they fail to meet their service agreements.
So if you're a railway, then it must feel kind of like you got some big guns trained on you all of a sudden. That's going to drive a certain amount of action, I would assume.
Yeah, I think there's a feeling that, you know, putting them under the microscope, they've been conscious of that, and maybe the railways wanting to avoid more regulation if they can, and so they've been improving, and not just the railways, the grain companies have been working, investing in export capacity at the ports, and according to Mark Hemis, the grain monitor, he believes that the communications has also improved, not only between the railways and grain shippers, the grain companies, but also within the companies, so that the grain company operations in the country is communicating better with the terminals at the port.
So when will we know if this is for real or if this is just sort of a short-term reaction from railways? How do we know for sure that we're in this new era that you talk about?
Well, that's the thing, you know, when I put that to the Western Grain Elevator Association's executive director, Wade Sopkowicz, he said, you know, it feels like we're in a new era because we set this throughput record, and we've had, if you include 2013-14, I guess interestingly, even though there was this big backlog, in the end, when that crop year ended, there was a new throughput record set then. And we've had two or three since then. So I think out of the last 4 years, we've had two or three records. So, you know, Wade feels it, says that there, it feels like a new record, or rather a new era. But he's just a little bit tentative. I guess he wants to see after the legislation becomes law, a couple of years into it, to just see if really we have turned a corner. And also, even if we have, we have to be realistic. Grain production is increasing. other traffic is coming back to the railways. So, you know, in the future, we'll still have weather issues, human-caused problems. So it's not going to be utopia. There's going to still be problems in the future. But I think the grain industry as a whole is hoping that we've put some of those terrible times in the past and things will be better in the future.
Can I ask, what about your personal opinion on this as a reporter? You've been, as you noted, following this a long time, probably a lot more dispassionately than people who are kind of in it on one side or the other. What about you? What's your sense?
Well, you know, I feel I'm optimistic, but again, I guess realistic. So many things can change, and depending on this new legislation, will it be effective in terms of encouraging the railways to try, bring the resources that are needed to move the crop in a timely way? If that legislation is going to hold their feet to the fire or not, it sounds a bit trite to say time will tell, but I guess that's the only way we'll really know. But I do feel that we're in a good place right now. That, as many people have pointed out, there has been more collaboration of late, better communication, and the whole industry has seen, you know, what is possible in terms of moving more grain through the system, and the railways have been investing, the grain companies have been too, and farmers have a lot of storage on farm and are part of the system. So I think there's a lot of room for optimism.
Great. Thanks for sharing that with us, Alan.
Thank you.
That was Alan Dawson of the Manitoba Cooperator. You're listening to Between the Rows, and I'm your host this week, Gord Gilmore. Up next is the Western Producers' Darce McMillan to tell us a bit about the StatsCan grain numbers. Hi, Darce. Thanks for joining us.
Good to be here, Gord.
So we've got a report coming out from StatsCan today. Can you tell us a bit about what it is?
Yeah, this is it's an annual report, and it comes out in August. It's based on farmers' surveys, and it's the first real look at the official look at the size of the Canadian crop. Of course, the numbers are important. It is that first look, but on the other hand, it almost always seems to be kind of dismissed by analysts.
Oh, really? Why is that?
Well, it is based on interviews, as I said, with farmers in late July, early August, and then about 3 weeks go by, and then the report comes out, and a lot can happen with the weather and with pests in those 3 weeks. A lot can happen with farmers' attitude towards their crop, because, of course, in mid-July, farmers, I think, are kind of naturally cautious about what's happening in their fields, and particularly this year because of a lot of a dry weather in a lot of areas in the prairies. And the farmers, you know, they don't want to count their chickens before they hatch.
Right. Now, you have looked at the history of the August report and gotten a bit of a feeling of the accuracy of your numbers, and I believe you mentioned you'll be writing about that in your column in this week's issue of the Western Producer.
It's out in this week's paper, and we'll have, of course, the actual StatsCan numbers in next week's paper, and also, of course, I would advise listeners to tune into our websites, agcanada.com, producer.com, and so on, because we will have all the same-day results of the StatsCan report up on our websites, and you can get kind of a jump on what the numbers are and what the trade is saying about that and the impact on the markets. But anyways, yeah, I looked at these some numbers from past years, and it was by no means an exhaustive study, but I did look at the past 5 years and compared the August report to the numbers in the final official tallies. And in the case of Statistics Canada, I looked at canola and the all wheat numbers. And I also, just for comparison's sake, I looked at the United States Department of Agriculture's numbers for soybeans and also the all wheat category.
Well, the suspense is killing me. What did you find?
Well, let me tell you about it, Gord. Almost always, the final tally is larger than what was expected in August. And in some cases, the final number is a lot larger than the early survey. In four of the past 5 years, the final canola production was larger than the August survey. And in 2012 was the only year when the final number was smaller, and that was down about 10%, I believe it was. But in 2013, the final tally on canola was more than 25% larger than it was in August. And in 2015, the final number was a whopping 38% larger than in August. In wheat, the final number was larger in all 5 years, ranging from just a little bit, about 1% larger in 2012, to 22% larger in the final tally in 2013.
That's interesting. Some big gaps there.
Yeah, yeah.
How did that compare with the USDA numbers then?
Well, in soybeans, the final tally was always bigger than the August outlook in those 5 years, although the degree of difference was maybe not as wide as it is in the Statistics Canada numbers. And the USDA's final wheat numbers were pretty close to the August forecast. But I think the reason for that is, of course, is that the U.S. winter wheat crop is really already in the bin. And they know that's a known quantity. And also, just because they're a little ahead of where we are in crop development, the spring wheat crop, by the time that USDA August report comes out, a lot of times some of the combines are already running in South Dakota and so on, and they have a pretty good handle, whereas up here in Canada we're a little bit farther away from harvest in at the point where the interviews are done.
So what conclusions did you draw from this this sort of analysis?
Well, for one thing, I think it disproves a feeling held by a small, but I think kind of a vocal minority out there that thinks that these government forecasters always overestimate the production outlook. A few people think that the agencies manipulate the numbers to drive down prices in pursuit of some sinister cheap food policy. But actually, these August reports underreport the amount of crop that is coming, and so they help to keep the price at a higher level than it might have been if we actually had a real, true idea of the size of the harvest.
So they're not purposely underestimating the crop size, is your view?
It's not the other way either. Yeah, no, I don't think it's simply, I think it's simply a case that you have incomplete data at this point of the year. Like I said, when farmers are surveyed in midsummer, they're pretty cautious about their yield projections. I guess there might be some out there who purposely lowball their estimates, trying to manipulate the market, but I think the impact of that is pretty short. The big players in the market, the grain companies and so on, they have their own estimates of crop size, and they know how hard or easy it is to pry grain from farmers' hands, and so that's another indication of just what farmers are thinking about. If they think they're going to have a small crop, then they're going to hang on pretty tightly to their grain in hand, and so the basis is going to have to change and that kind of thing. Also, these production reports are just one factor in price discovery. The forecasts of production from South America and Europe, the Black Sea region, are also woven into the price discovery.
And that's become more important, like especially the Black Sea this year. Isn't their wheat crop supposed to be huge? Must be weighing on wheat prices.
For sure, yeah. It is a case that here in today's report will likely show that Stats Can, the domestic wheat production is down. The USDA has said that wheat production is down in the United States as well. But the Russian crop is apparently, it's record-breaking. Russia's wheat production is really benefiting from what must be ideal weather the past couple of years. In last year, 2016, the wheat crop was almost 20% larger than it was in 2015. And now this year, the forecasts are saying that wheat production will be about 7% bigger again. The crop will be 16 to 17 million tons more than it was just 2 years ago. And I think when you get a big bumper crop like that, you're going to have some infrastructure limitations that just might limit the amount of wheat, just how much they can actually take advantage of and how much they can move.
Well, that's a familiar problem. Wonder if they'll do any better with a bumper crop than we did in 2013-14.
Yeah, well, of course, they get winter too, hey? But a lot of their production is closer to port than ours is. It'll certainly be interesting to watch and to compare their experience with what we had a few years back.
Well, that's great. Thanks, Darce, for joining us and telling us a bit about what we should be thinking about as those numbers come out and we look at them.
Glad to be here, Gord. Thanks.
Have a good day.
Bye-bye.
That's another edition of Between the Rows. I'm your host, Gord Gilmore. Join us again next week for a roundup of what's happening in agriculture. In the meantime, best of luck with the harvest and stay safe out there.
We hope you enjoyed this episode of Between the Rows. Our goal at Bayer is to continue to progress our lineup of high-performing seed and crop protection solutions so that we can meet specific grower needs like yours. Because when it comes to your farm, Bayer is with you from beginning to end. Between the Rows is a production of Glacier Farm Media, Canada's leading farm publisher. We'd love to hear what you think of the show and invite you to send your comments to btr@farmmedia.com or visit us at membersgetmore.ca and sign up today.